This week's episode is sponsored by Star Rat Records. Out now is Ningún Humano Es Illegal, a new benefit compilation featuring some of the best screamo bands in North and South America, including Habak, Vientre, Quiet Fear, Satón, Macanera, Zeta, and many more. All profits from this release will go to El Refugio, a nonprofit that helps immigrants detained at Stewart Detention Center in Georgia. These funds will go towards commissary accounts, books, plane and bus tickets for people who are released, and financial assistance to families impacted by detention and deportation. Go to starratrex.bandcamp.com to order a tape or purchase the album digitally. That's StarRatsRecs.bandcamp.com. Hello, and welcome to Everything Remade, a podcast that I hope is about growth as much as it is about music. I'm Edie Quinn, and we have a great show lined up for you today. Before we get started, though, I'd like to remind you that we have a Patreon page at patreon.com/humanmachine. You can sign up today and get immediate access to all the zines I've been doing over the last 2 years, get music sneak peeks, and so much more. That's patreon.com/humanmachine. And now I'd like to play something for you. You're hearing The Drum, The Beat by Outer World, featuring the many musical talents of my new pal, Tracy Wilson. The song comes from their brand new album, Who Does the Music Love?, which you can order online now or grab from them when they're on tour in just a couple of weeks.
As a guitar player, I was really interested in what was happening in Archers of Loaf and the Tree People. I think there was like a winding guitar, like almost a conversation happening between the guitar players that I thought was just mind blowing. And I don't know, it really made me want to learn what that language was. And I didn't play guitar at all. So I was basically starting from ground zero. It was a long journey to remotely get close to understanding how and what they were doing, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. What about as a vocalist?
Gosh, so I've been singing much to the horror of most of my family members pretty much since I was old enough to talk. I really, really liked singing a lot. So, like a lot of girls in my age group, the Broadway show Annie, I know Kathleen Hanna talks about this too, like singing like to like nauseam points of over and over again, the songs from Annie. But then, just singing to the radio, weirdly, it never occurred to me, like I did school plays and things, but I never thought like that could be me in a band. That wasn't really until much later, like out of high school, that someone's like, you should just try singing in a band and see how that goes. Like, I don't know. I feel like such an idiot that I didn't know that I could apply my interests in like a more direct way of participating. I was always like much more on the fan side of music. Like I've been collecting records since, I don't know, like fifth grade or something. So crossing that line from fan to musician didn't really happen until I was leaving high school. So like early 1990-ish.
Yeah. In your record collecting, were you just not seeing a lot of yourself in the records that you like, were there just not a lot of people that looked like you and sounded like you and like represented in your collection that you're that split between like I could do this and like I really love this was still there?
Again, I feel like such a dummy because my first record I ever bought was the Go-Go's.
Okay.
I loved like Pat Benatar and Laura Branigan. Like there were clearly lots of female musicians on the radio.
Yeah.
But it just seemed like the top 40 world was so like unreachable that I don't know. I didn't know yet that there was like an underground DIY scene that would let anybody try it.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seemed like a bridge that like I didn't know how to cross. So it wasn't until, there was like a couple things that happened once I figured out there was a world of music that was not top 40. And you know, that's kind of like a revelation, right? Like most, yeah. Well, maybe now it's a little bit less of a surprise, but when your only exposure growing up is basically what is on the radio that your parents play or what your older siblings might be bringing home on tape or record, like that was all I knew about what was out in the world. So until you accidentally start discovering other spots on the radio dial that are like playing songs that are unlike anything you've ever heard before, you're like, oh, wait, what is this? And then writing some things down, like accidentally watching like late night music videos of like Midnight Oil was a group that was before they ever had like a big hit. The video was like so alarming and cool, but I was like, I don't have any like point of recognition on this at all. So I wrote down some things that I liked and then walked to a record store and they were like, oh, you seem to like punk rock and alternative music or whatever they were calling it, like college radio. And they like basically took a bag from the record store and wrote down a ton of different bands for me to check out. And then whenever I got my allowance or my mom would take me to the store, I cross off like a couple more. I don't know. It blew my mind that there was this whole world of music that was like much more secretive and yet somehow could be for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And then understanding that there was like a role that you could play in that, whether you were making like a writer as a fanzine person or a photographer at shows. Like it wasn't until I started working at the record store and meeting other people who were playing instruments and in bands that were like really supportive of saying like, if you like these things, you should at least just try seeing if you could do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it was a Fire Party record, like an early Discord release of an all lady band. And it completely, I think that was the first time I had heard like heavy emotional music that made me want to try it. And then Babes in Toyland, the Lunatics, L7, then all of a sudden it was like, oh, PJ Harvey. These were all women that still seemed like, I didn't feel like we were the same. They still felt like more famous somehow, like especially like the year that punk broke or whatever.
Yeah.
Everybody was in like every magazine. Like it still seemed like some sort of next level. But then they would play Maxwell's and smaller clubs where like I would be standing 2 feet away from them and I could talk to them after a show. Like that's when I understood a little bit more about the dynamic of the DIY world and that the sort of like curtain between band and audience doesn't exist there. You're sort of, it's almost an equal playing field. And that's when I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. I want to try this. I may not be good at it, but, I want to at least say that I gave it my best. And if I fail, like whatever, but having like zero expectations of like being a band and making it, just like baby steps, like somebody loaning me their guitar, somebody loaning me their amp, trying out with strangers. I definitely did not know at the time, but some people that were in the room were in Dahlia Seed and, not really knowing how to even try out in a band and just like it's super intimidating to have strangers play a song and say, can you sing something over that? Like if you've never had to do that before, like, I, you know, it's not an easy thing to practice. I guess you could listen to instrumental records and see what, like, vocals you make from it. But it's not until you're kind of, like, thrown to the deep end of trying it that you're like, oh, I think I can actually do this. And it was, like, a pleasant surprise to have that work out and then keep being asked to come back again and maybe write some songs and then, you know, slowly spiraling out from there into something that almost sounded like a proper band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, you know, the... A lot of my projects and stuff are more like just chaotic, like screaming and stuff. And a lot of like, it's like folks won't be able to relate to that as much. Like how you, as a vocalist, where you're, you know, it's based in melody. It is really, no matter, like it was a few years ago, you know, like that I was trying out for a band where like I played bass, but also I was doing vocals, and it was like a melodic band. And I was just like, what do you do? Like until you've actually you can kind of BS a little bit and just like, you know, hum some harmonies like while you're going and see if they start like making those words happen in your brain or whatever, but it feels so weird, like still, and I'm like 20 years of it playing in bands at that point, you know? It's
So actually I have a question about that then. So what was it about screaming that you felt comfortable doing? Because as a woman who is often told not to talk about anything, you know, like kind of keep quiet, in a very like coming out of the 60s with parents who were raised in the 40s and 50s, like women weren't really given powerful positions, no less to be outspoken in certain things, no less definitely not screaming in a band. So that for me, like it was the reverse, like learning that I actually had that ability to scream or growl or like be aggressive in a band, like mm-hmm. that definitely was a no-no in my world. So it took me a long time to get there. So I'm so fascinated. How did you come out of the gate screaming and then find the reverse later that the melody was the hard part?
Well, I think with me, it's like I always had a hard time reining my voice in. I can't sing like I can't sing quiet very well. And once you start like when you're really coming out of your diaphragm and once you start getting that volume, like I've always had that to where my voice will break up like no matter what. So to me, when I was playing in like melodic punk bands and I'm doing my best to not be gravelly or, you know, whatever, when screamo, you know, or like, you know, emotional hardcore start happening in like the, you know, mid to late 90s, that was like, to me, permission to not like that was just like everything that you've been fighting like to keep yourself in check, like let it go, forget about it. And so that was like really cathartic for me, that I just could, I just had permission all of a sudden to just like, as gnarly as my voice will get, like the better almost, you know, like
so how did you practice that?
It was kind of just like, you know, you just be real frustrated about everything and you just start just throwing words out in some kind of cadence. And you know, bands back then, a lot of times bands were like just writing the lyrics like afterwards, like there was bands that, you know, their whole thing was like they'll record the album and write the lyrics like afterwards. And so that was like easier to comprehend, you know, that you, and I mean, I was in a band like in like 2017, right, where I like I wasn't on any of the recordings, but like the last year the band was a band, like I played more shows with them as the vocalist than their actual vocalist by like a lot. And their vocalist was like, you can just sing whatever you want. Like, I don't share my lyrics. So I just like was like one time, like my, you know, my grandma had just died. And so I just like freestyle, just like yelled for 20 minutes, like about what was going on. And, yeah,
when
it was
did you
just,
realize that that was cathartic?
I don't know, you know, because I didn't, like, a lot of times, you know, with some of this stuff that happened to me when I was a kid, and, you know, and, like, I never felt like I had an outlet for that. And so all of a sudden, it wasn't just, like, playing loud music and playing fast music. It was also, like, delivering this, like, extreme physicality with it as well, and just like just all the pent up like energy or whatever, and just trying to spill it in, you know, 18 to 20 minutes or whatever.
Right.
So yeah, it was I don't know, like I said, it was like that was easier for me. And like, you know, my whole point was just like, it's just I don't know how people just like it, you said like, yeah, once you've had the instrumentals to work with, and then you can get your lines and you can maybe like find a way to sort of practice them on your own. Then you go back in with the band and you're like, then you're sounding like, yeah, this is good. Like, and it sounds like everybody's, you know, on the same page and knows what they're doing. But before that, it's like, it, like now a guitar player can just record the song on their iPhone, send it to the vocalist. The vocalist can be practicing before the two of them are ever even in the same room, you know? But, like, we didn't have that luxury always, you know? So it's,
Right.
It's interesting to, you know, reflect on that for sure. So you said, like, the first time that you ended up playing with anybody, it was some folks that you'd later be in Dahlia Seed with, which...
So, Danny Durello, that was in the hardcore group Underdog.
Uh-huh.
He had a band with some people, and I think they had placed some sort of ad in like a local paper. And while I was working at the record store, I was like, oh, this is a really strange band ad looking for a singer. Cause it was like Black Sabbath, Nancy Sinatra, Mudhoney, and like, I don't know, King Crimson, or like something like wacky that didn't like usually get all squished into one band sort of newspaper ad.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, huh, the area code kind of looks like it's near me, like where I was living with my parents. And I was like, well, I'm just going to answer it and see what happens. And so I think they were sort of surprised to discover that it was a woman that answered the ad. And so when I showed up at the house, there was sort of like a bunch of people hanging out, which is super intimidating too, because you're like, who are all of these people? Yeah. And am I going to die? Like, is this my last night on earth because I answered some weird newspaper ad and now I'm with like six dudes in a basement? Cool. Yeah. And they played like a punk rock version of an Edie Brickell song. And I was like, I don't really, I'm not interested in doing covers. That's just not fun for me. And so then they played like an original song and then had me try to sing on top of it. And one of the other people in the room was Chris, the founding member of Dahlia Seed. And I don't know, we took like a break and he and his best friend were like, let's go get some, like I wasn't old enough to drink, but he was. He's like, let's go get some beers and we'll talk about some stuff. And I was like, okay. And he's like, don't join this group. They're terrible. I'm starting a new band. You should totally play with my band. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, I don't know any of you. So trusting any of this, like, okay. So weirdly, like Chris ended up becoming more of like a grown up music guru who was just constantly teaching me about all different kinds of records, because he was just a little bit older and had a better understanding of like 60s garage rock and psychedelic music, but then also new metal and hardcore. he was just all over the place and could make like the best mixtapes. And so he and his best friend were sort of like, I didn't really have a ton of friends in high school. I was just the weirdo record nerd and with dreads, I think, at the time. So really, I didn't have a lot of people in my school to hang out with and go to shows with. So I did a lot of just going to shows with Chris, and then that evolved into him starting Dahlia Seed and then eventually asking me, I don't know, maybe after 6 months of them forming and having some songs to try singing. But like, it's kind of interesting that he knew immediately that we should be in a band together.
Yeah. I mean, especially because I can't imagine that band any other way. I mean, this is hindsight, of course, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But, yeah, it's, that's wild. And, you know, you got poached, you know, from, it was like, don't join them. Like Chris immediately immediate was putting that recipe together, you know?
I mean, what a ballsy move, right? Just totally poaching me from one band that I barely, and like, I can't even imagine anything I did being good enough that someone was like, I like you, kid. Come with me.
Yeah,
like,
you got the moxie.
It was definitely not good. But, you know, I appreciate that he heard something in me. And, like, literally, I'd never been in a band before. So, like, he, Darren, and Brian were all, like, some of the more, like, original members. We had one or two other bass players, but they were pretty much there from almost the beginning. And all three of them had been in different hardcore bands before. So, like, they kind of knew how it worked, but it was all totally new to me. So, I don't know. I was super green. They were really patient in teaching me kind of how to write songs together. And it changed as the band went on. At first, we did a lot more writing all in the same room. And then when I moved to Seattle while the band was still going, we would be mailing demos back and forth. And then I would sort of tape record myself singing to the demos, or if I was playing guitar and writing a song, I would kind of like make a rough demo and then mail it to them, and then the three of them would practice it in a room together. And then when we'd see each other, like, I don't know, every 6 months or something, then we would kind of fine-tune the songs to really like make them sound like what we knew Dahlia Seed to be. So it was really, I don't know, it was interesting. Like, once we felt safe enough to let everybody kind of do their own thing and bring it back and then have us all work on it together, it was like, I don't know, it was a really beautiful thing to have.
Yeah, for sure.
Other people trust you enough to start bringing in songs. Like, I don't know, because my husband, Kenny, and I have been in a bunch of bands together, we're so often the songwriters, and it's really hard to let somebody just come in and start bringing in songs because, I don't know, they don't know like our style yet. And because usually it's already like formed group, you don't like want to completely switch directions with like a new person in their style of song. So, I don't know. It's really nice when people trust you enough to be able to try bringing in new songs and seeing what happens. Cause Chris was really the primary songwriter. And then, I pretty much took over half of the writing within just a couple of years, like maybe just a year and a half.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't, you know, I'm obviously not trying to put words in anyone's mouth, but I've often said that, you know, sometimes for me personally, that like, when I can just tell that someone is like hungry for it, like that makes me like, that's more than I need to know, like about someone's abilities. Like somebody who really wants to do this is, in my book, like whether somebody else already has like all the chops and whatever, like somebody that really wants to do this, like, even if they're green, like you said, that beats the other thing every day in my book, because
right, passion over skill.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, like you're talking about like these other people who were in all these hardcore bands. And sometimes, you know, I'm not saying them specifically, but sometimes people just get to that thing where they feel like they've done it all and they've seen it all. And it's like, I don't want to be involved with people like that. I want everyone to feel like the new thing is the best thing they've ever been a part of, you know? And it's like, right. For sure that's hard to maintain, you know, but yeah. So
and I'm sure it was like a pretty big learning curve for them because they had all been in like a very boys club, hardcore crossover to the metal world scene. Mm-hmm. So there were like not very many women in that world, like in bands that they were playing with.
Yeah.
So I'm sure like it must have been a really curious thing to play a style of music with a totally different kind of singer who was also bringing in more of an indie rock guitar style than the jigga 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 thing that mm-hmm. they were all like, you know, their foundation was coming from. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe that juxtaposition of those two worlds kind of makes what Dolly Seed was so unique, or at least at the time. Now it's, I won't say a dime a dozen, but I think that blending of like heavy with more indie rock vocals is like much more common. But then like we didn't know anybody who was really doing that yet.
Dahlia Seed was such a big band for me personally because, you know, you mentioned like the guitar work of Archers of Loaf or whatever that you were admiring. Mm-hmm. And then, so, I mean, cause I was like, you know, really into like a lot of bands with, you know, similar vocals to Dahlia Seed, but none of those bands had the kind of guitar work that Dahlia Seed had. And it was this really, you know, perfect, and I think, you know, still, I think it's very unique. I don't think a lot of bands, you know, do that. I don't know. I think, like, one thing that I don't know if this was always the case, but what I think is really interesting, especially about the time, is, you know, you mentioned, like, you know, the hardcore bands that they were in, and that's like, you know, pretty much like their friend group, peer group at the time, bands they were used to playing with. Like back then it was still pretty common for bands like Dahlia Seed to play with just a straight up like heavy hardcore band or whatever.
And it was like you would have either like we'd be in a full-on beatdown hardcore bill,
uh-huh,
or there might be like a random metal band sprinkled in, or it would be the exact opposite where it would be like super indie rock and then we were 10 times heavier than everybody. But for the most part we were almost always put on hardcore bills because that's just kind of like where their connections were from.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, like there's something pretty humbling about playing a space that every single person who was on that stage was a guy and they were all like flexing their masculinity,
mm-hmm,
times infinity. And then there's me and I'm wearing saddle shoes and I have a Hello Kitty backpack and like whatever other stupid 90s things I was probably wearing then. And like literally people would see that and want to walk out of the room, or they did walk out of the room because they wouldn't even give that a chance. And I don't know, within like just 6 months or something, we were often heavier than a lot of the bands with other boys that day or that night on the show. So like people eventually figured out that girls could be in a heavy band, but God, it took a long time to cut through like our Northeast kind of hardcore, post-hardcore scene and be like, feel like we were welcomed and people understood what we were rather than having to sort of like teach them that it was possible for this kind of band to exist and that maybe it wouldn't be terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, because that's what I was going to ask is like, you know, in hindsight, I'm seeing the flyers like, and it's what you described and what, you know, I thought, but like I was going to ask, like, you know, did you have that thing happening at that time where like people would try to build a bill that was not heavy because they were pigeonholing you all and saying like, you'll fit better with this? Or was it just like you said, where it's just like, you just show up and you try to turn heads and it might take a minute, but eventually it was happening?
It really kind of evolved. So when we first started playing, like 93-ish, that year I felt like we played a lot of dumb hardcore shows and had to like fight to be heard over and over and over again. And then as people sort of got a sense of what we did, then the bills sort of got a little bit more melodic. But I almost, like, there wasn't really a great fit. Like, Seaweed was kind of doing a melodic heavy thing, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's honestly the closest thing I can think of vocally, at least, to what we were doing. I think otherwise we were, you know, pretty obsessed with all the things that were happening in San Diego. So Pitchfork, Drive Like Jehu, Rocket. That kind of world of bands that would evolve into the sort of Gravity screamo scene. But I don't know, those influences, like there weren't a lot of bands that sounded like that besides Garden Variety, which I think is how we ended up playing so many shows with Garden Variety, because even though vocally they were more like maybe on the squirrel bait kind of realm, and then certainly like all the San Diego bands, like they just had a little bit more melody and they weren't like macho hardcore guys. I felt like they were our brothers in a different band. Like we instantly felt like a pretty tight kinship with them. So they were probably the only band I can think of that like we had a really like not just a personal connection with, but really felt like our bands coincided with each other really nicely.
Yeah. Was that when Steve Niles was in the band?
In Garden Variety?
Isn't that the band that's, maybe I'm thinking of a different band. I thought so. There's a famous comic writer and he was in I thought it was Garden Variety. He wasn't in the band the whole time though.
No, I don't think that's that same group.
Yeah, it's something. Oh, that's really gonna bug me, but that's okay. I'll
things we can Google later.
Yeah, things that I can tack on to the end of the episode. Steve Niles' band was very good, and also Garden Variety is very good, and I'm perhaps mixing the two of them together. Like what I think we were finding in the different bands that I was in back, you know, in the like mid to late 90s is there just weren't like the like everybody now is like, oh yeah, mixed bills are awesome. And I agree. But like the reason why so many shows were mixed bills back then is because there just weren't enough like places that were willing to let like, you know, basically like DIY bands like do things, and there weren't enough like bands at that same level that you could play with. And so that's why like a lot of this happened. And then, you know, the other thing is like, you know, sometimes you would have people trying to like curate a bill to, you know, more have the bands be similar or whatever, but sometimes it just wasn't possible. But yeah, it was
I mean, imagine trying to book a venue in like 1990. So you don't have, you can't like Google whoever is in a genre realm. So if you're trying to put together like a doom bill, you couldn't just Google doom bands from whatever like region you're in and reach out to random people. So like you're kind of working with whoever you have on your radar and who's played there. So like, you know, they might have a spreadsheet with all the bands that have played their venue and then like a couple of, you know, general definitions of the kind of music they played. And then they would look at that list and then try to piece things together that they thought maybe made sense. Or like a touring band might say like, hey, we're friends with so-and-so. Is it cool if they play too? But like, I don't know. It's so hard in like pre-internet days to build bills that seem to have like a very fluid, made sense kind of thing. I think it was much more about like an organic regional scene than anything to do with putting bills together by genre.
Yeah. And I mean, it's still kind of the same way as far as like one aspect, which was just like when you book a tour because you knew somebody in that city and you just want to see your friend, you know? So whatever kind of band they were in, that's the kind of band you were going to play with, you know? So sometimes that was, sometimes that's still the case, but,
yeah, the like pen pal thing is, is a real tour, like real touring tool.
Yeah, for
like,
sure.
I can't tell you like almost every favorite band I had during that time period, I also was pen pals with them. And then they would also kind of give me like little scene reports. So they'd be like, oh, here's what's happening in Olympia. And then you'd know like, oh, okay. Sam from Link mentioned these four bands and one of them like Unwound is coming to town. We should check them out. And that like was a really slow moving word of mouth, but like, I don't know, you really like built a roadmap and community from those kinds of connections. And then everybody who toured would make more friends and their pen pal list would go a little bit longer. And then if a band in their scene would say like, do you know anybody in San Diego? We want to play there. They'd be like, oh yeah, I write letters and talk to blah, blah, blah. And then you would kind of add on to that community. It's, and that definitely still happens, but I don't know. I definitely miss getting really good pen pal packages that would have like maybe like some homemade artwork and then a mixtape and then maybe a shirt of their favorite band or cookies. Like, I don't know. I always used to get great packages.
Yeah. And some weird chick tracks and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think like I remember like before Book Your Own Life and stuff, I remember seeing like reading like some issues of Comet Bus or something and being like, oh, this band from that place sounds cool or, you know, whatever and stuff like that.
Yeah, I feel like Born Against and Rorschach had like a tour list that was constantly growing of like trusted friends. And I think maybe it also included some places to eat. But I feel like Born Against and Rorschach were like in our world had the best, like laid the best groundwork for the rest of us to sort of mooch off of and figure out like, oh, okay, that person, do you think they're still doing shows in Wisconsin? Like the only way you'd know for sure is if you called them or something. But
yeah,
their list was like something we relied on and leaned on pretty heavily.
For sure. Yeah, there was always like, you know, someone had a list that came from somewhere and you have your like calls and lots of out of date numbers and, you know, like just like waiting with like gritted teeth for that like $300 phone bill or whatever. But
yep.
But yeah.
Oh, so many pay phones that we used to like have that little like, I don't know, friends that were good at building stuff had that, I don't know what it was called, but it could trick the payphone and made it sound like you're dropping quarters in and then you could get free phone calls. So, man, that was like such a sacred tool of any touring band who didn't have money for long distance calls, because we use that for like every payphone to follow up in the next city, like, is the show still happening before we drive 7 hours? And I can't even imagine how we could have afforded to book that otherwise. Or, like, you know, our parents paid a lot of our phone bills too.
I really could talk about Dahlia Seed for a long time, but we'll start moving on. But I just want to ask one question. So, Dahlia Seed had a couple splits with other bands that you were also in. Like, was this just like necessity? Were the bands touring together, or was it like, hey, this would be funny? Like, because I've wanted to do that. I've always thought it would be funny to do a split and I'm in both bands. That'd be funny. So, like, how did the split, like the Dahlia Seed, excuse me, Broken Mouth or the Dahlia Seed Dune Buggy split, how did those happen?
So, Broken Mouth was me kind of, well, okay, let me backtrack. So, working at the record store, these two guys would come in and they were in a band together called Dune Buggy. And they said, like, hey, we're going to record at like this local community college. I think it might even be free, or it was super cheap, if not free. If you can learn how to like play guitar well enough and write a song, you should be like, let's do a split 7-inch together and I'll put it out. And so it kind of dared me to write a song and record it. And so I did, and I wrote the song Shiloh. And I think from there, I sort of played a little bit in Dune Buggy, but then Broken Mouth became my, like, learning how to do my own songwriting. And so it was members of Dune Buggy, my boyfriend at the time, which was Phil. And he was in a bunch of bands. I think at that point he was in Earth Pig. And then members of The Fiends, I think, helped out for a song or two. So, like, that helped me kind of cut my teeth. And I, by the time those recordings were done, Dahlia Seed had started to happen. And then I had had enough material to do, like, a split record. And a woman who I think was working at Frontier, like the big West Coast punk label. She started her own record label and was like, I'll put out a record of yours. And I was like, oh, well, I think I don't have enough songs for like a full record, but I could do half a side. And then maybe my new other band, Dahlia Seed, could do the other half. And so I think that's how that split came about.
Oh, okay. So the timeline, I have the timeline sort of backwards.
So I think, like, sometimes things came out, like, after the fact, but
sure.
Really I was, like, Broken Mouth was sort of bubbling under before Dahlia Seed really, like, was fully formed and kind of had its own legs.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And so some of the other split 7-inches, like with Grey House or with Garden Variety, those were just record labels that, like, to kind of curate a sound or whatever. And so Trouble Band chose Grey House because they were sort of like up and coming as our like kind of local Fugazi-ish kind of band. And then Vinny, who worked at Dutch East, because I was working at a record store, I was talking to a lot of distributors, and Vinny was a sales rep at Dutch East, and that's kind of how I knew that he had a label. And then he started coming to our shows, and his like two favorite kind of groups at that time would be us and Garden Variety. So to him it just felt really natural because we played so many shows together. Like, it was a great sort of development of something that was already there, and it was just, you know, for posterity's sake to have it on a split 7-inch was awesome.
When you said Grey House, I was reminded that I believe that Steve Niles' band was called Grey Matter. I think we cleared that up. But it's wild. Like, you know, Dahlia Seed did not on paper look like that y'all were a band for very long, at least as far as like, you know, what I can glean off of like.
No, not at all.
Right. But y'all did a whole lot of stuff. And I mean, still two of my favorite albums in Valentine's Kids Litter and Survived By, just like amazing albums. When you moved on from there, was the next, so I guess this is where I don't know what the timeline looks like for you, because Positive No is like the next thing where it looks like you, you know, really spent a lot of time and wrote a lot of material, but also like Ring Finger was a thing that you were working on since like 2007 is what I read. So after Dahlia Seed, was that sort like, I mean, there's like a lot of time there, but was that so your sort of next thing? Or
kind of weird is, as sort of popular in the region as Dahlia Seed was, nobody asked me like when our band fell apart to be in a new band. So I started a side project with my boyfriend at the time called Scissorettes. And that was just like a goofy home recording thing. And then that sort of expanded into a project called Souvenir. And we only did some demos, both Scissorettes and Souvenir. And Souvenir played a couple of shows, and William from Sunny Day was our drummer for a hot second. And then Darren from Dahlia Seed was our drummer for a little while. And there, after Dahlia Seed, there was a group called The 17th, which was basically the core members of Dahlia Seed with another guitar player. And that just, I don't know really what happened there. It just sort of never came to be. And I think we were all kind of burnt out, like the demise of Dahlia Seed got kind of messy. And it just can be grueling being in a band that doesn't really go anywhere, and you're constantly losing money and fans are constantly breaking down. Like, it's a lot of testing of patience. And after a while, like, you know, 5 or 6 years of that, it can eventually, you come to your senses and you're like, is this a good idea? Can I afford to like couch surf on my friends like forever? I don't know. That's like not necessarily the life I had dreamed of. Yeah. And also, like, being homeless kind of is pretty stressful. So when I started to work at a distributor called Caroline, it's a music distributor, mm-hmm. That's sort of where, like, I'd stepped away from being in a full-time band and sort of dipped my toes into a career. And that's when I had, like, kind of these home recording projects. And then somewhere along the line, I was introduced to Steve from Cave-In, and then we were pen pals, and then we were mailing demos back and forth to each other and kind of adding things here and there. And so we made some 4-track songs together, and that was sort of the beginning of the Ring Finger record.
Okay.
So when I moved away from New York City, I started my life in Richmond. And like a bunch of terrible things happened. I went through a divorce. I lost a brother, both of my parents, a grandparent. I didn't really know very many people in Richmond. So I started working on completing the Ring Finger record. So I had the, like, half of it was sort of demoed out with Steven. But then there was like 6 or so songs that I started from scratch. And then completed that record. And it took a full decade. So Decimal is marking 10. So it's 10 years of me kind of grieving and putting that into a more productive place. And finally, that record coming out in the late, like, whatever, 2007 or whatever. And then not really, like, I'm still working at different music distributors. And so that's like my primary daytime life. Mm-hmm. And I'm buying records and collecting and writing about music, but I didn't nobody wanted to play music with me. It was weird. I didn't get asked to be a part of something else. And the momentum of Ring Finger never really took off. And for a hot second, I played in a band called Down with the Ship with Dave Witte, who's the drummer in Municipal Waste, and he was in Discordant Axis. And we did like maybe 5 or 6 songs and a band together, like right before I moved to Richmond. But then that never really took off. So it was just a lot of, I don't know, dead ends. And it wasn't till I met my now husband, Kenny, that we started working on songs together. And I don't think we had any dreams of it becoming anything. And then a friend of ours was like, these are really good. You should make this a band. And that's where Positive No came to be. And then, I don't know, I think we did that for 7 years or something.
Yeah. I think that the first release said 2013, and then the last release, Kaya Night, if I'm saying that right, was your Valentine's present to the world on in 2020. It's wild because, you know, like that's a really hard story, like as far as, you know, to hear, just because, and I wonder if people just thought, I don't know. I guess I really can't guess why no one would have asked you, you know, to be a part of something.
I never get asked to, well, I think maybe like once or twice people have asked me to sing on records, but like, I don't know, maybe there's something about me that's not approachable. I don't know.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, me personally, sometimes when I am, I have a band where I've just admired their work, and it took me, I was on, like my friend Tom, I played in bands with Tom's bands, like we'd play shows together, and then our bands did like 2 or 3 tours together rather before I was eventually like, hey Tom, will you play some bass on some of my band's songs, you know? Right. So like, I don't know, I mean, certainly like not everybody would have been in that camp where they're just like felt embarrassed to ask, you know, but that could have been some of it. I mean, like, I know that you are probably like, you know, I saw your post about like, yeah, and you just have like stacks of these Dahlia Seed shirts and stuff that you're mailing out and stuff. I know that you're probably feeling now like a lot of gratitude towards the band and stuff, that like, not to say that you never felt gratitude towards the band when the band was active, but it's so hard to recognize that when you're in a situation like you're describing, where you're like literally like you're couch surfing, your vans are constantly breaking down. Like, it's hard to be like, wow, people really like this band, when it's a struggle to keep the band going.
Yeah, you're definitely not defining success in the traditional sense. Like, you might feel like you've hit amazing like growth spurts as a musician, but like, you're still not paying your bills.
Yeah. So like,
I think most of that, I don't know, I think even now, like watching Numero reissue like literally every band we're friends with and peers with, like, we don't get included. Like, anytime there's like lists of best emo bands, like, we're definitely never on any of them. Like, I guess maybe we're just more of an acquired taste. I don't really know. Like, it might seem like maybe like a few more people are like giving us accolades now, but I definitely don't feel like any more seen than I did, you know, 30 years ago. I think we have this weird, very specific cult following, and every so often something wild might come up where like somebody will show us a tattoo that they have of us, or I don't know, there'll be these amazing, like, humbling moments, but, like, we are definitely never going to reach the same point of, like, unwound or, you know, universal order of Armageddon. Yeah. Or, you know, I don't know. There's certain bands that continue to get sort of, like, name check, and we are not one of them.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I don't know. The real ones know. We know. But, yeah. It is funny that you mentioned Tattoo, though, because I think I told you this story. So, I saw At the Drive-In several years ago, and it was before, you know, they really took off. We saw them in a room. It was a restaurant that was like, well, it was a bar, right? But it was like similar to a BW3s or something. And we saw them like on like this, you know, concrete floor, and, you know, all the tables were pushed to the side. There's like 50 people there actually watching the show.
The best way to see them, yeah.
Absolutely. And then there was like this whole other upstairs-ish kind of area where people were just like watching football and drinking and eating wings and stuff, right? So like, but anyway, weirdest show, right? And I go up to the vocalist after the show because he had the artwork, which you all used on the cover of Survived By. And I did not know that that was someone else's artwork. I only knew that artwork by the association from your CD. And I was like, oh, you like Dahlia Seed? And he was like, what? He was like offended. Like, he had no idea what I was talking about. And I point to the artwork and I was like, that's on their album cover. And he was like, I mean, who is it? Raymond Pettibon? Is that?
No, it's like were like, it was like 50s clip art almost.
Okay. Well, he knew the name of the artist and he was like, no, it's this artist. And I was like, okay. And I just sort of like apologized.
So what's interesting about that story is, so I saw them play in New York City, and is it Omar that has the, I don't even remember anymore which member it is.
It's the vocalist. It was maybe the guitar player. And I always forget. I think the vocalist is Cedric, right?
Oh, no. So I think it's Omar who has the tattoo. And
okay.
So one of the songs sounded so much like Dahlia Seed. And then at some point, my friend that is at the show with me, like, elbows me and is like, that's
the artwork.
Dahlia Seed cover? Like, what's up with that? So then I go up to him after the show. And I was like, hey, is it cool if I, you know, like, great show. Can you tell me a little bit about your tattoo? And he just got super awkward. He was like, whatever. Like, you're not, it's just this band. Blah. And I was like, well, what band? And he said, Dahlia Seed. And
really?
I was like, oh, that's me. I'm the singer, Tracy. So nice to meet you. Wow, you have our album art on your arm. That's crazy. And we exchanged information. We never wrote to each other or anything, but it was like, he seemed really embarrassed at that moment. I don't know. So I don't know why he would not say that otherwise, but.
Yeah, maybe it was a, maybe it was a, I don't know. I have no idea.
I have a witness on the sidewalk.
Yeah,
in front
no.
Of the show that definitely we had a conversation about.
Yeah.
Dahlia Seed. It was very weird.
That's wild. Like, maybe he just didn't like me. which is fine.
Weird, right? Like,
yeah.
They might be not interested in talking that much, or
yeah.
Or maybe he was lying to me and was just like, he knew, and I don't know. Weird, right?
What if one, I wonder which thing happened, I wonder which one of us met him in which order. And I don't know.
This that would probably be for me 99.
Okay.
What? Or 2000 ish.
Yeah.
It was right before I moved to Richmond.
I have a hard time.
Like, pretty big shows.
I have a hard time remembering like what year or whatever, but it was a wild tour because they were on tour with the Get Up Kids, and this was before the Get Up Kids were really very big. Either, but they had just released something to write home about. So it's right in that area. It was the Get Up Kids and At the Drive-In, and also this band called Ultimate Fake Book.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah. They sold their records at Caroline.
And also this band played called Hot Rod Circuit, which, like,
yep.
my band.
I have a whole history with them, which is another. That could be a whole other podcast, to be honest.
I was just going to say, my band had played a show separately with Hot Rod Circuit at some other point. So I actually don't even, like, are they? I just assumed that they were a Midwest band at that point from, you know, around somewhere around here, because we had played with them in Dayton and that show was in Illinois. And but anyway,
right.
Yeah, it was a very, very interesting show. And like, I mean, just amazing show. Like, what a couple of bands to see in a room with only 50 people. And especially like both bands sort of at their prime in
right,
like,
yeah.
my opinion, because like this is like, I think they maybe played like a song like being like, this is a new song, and that would be a song that would end up on Relationship of Command or whatever, but
right
yeah. But yeah, just that's wild. So the jury is out on why he was mean to me. Maybe I just, you know, sometimes it's,
or I guess like the real question is, so is it a Deli Seed related tattoo or not?
Yeah we
honestly, I'm cool either way.
Yeah, for sure, we need to know though. I'll have him on the podcast. Why were you mean to me? And also, Deli Seed rules.
Social media kind of happened and we could stay in touch that way. And then I don't know, so many of our friends were recording there and I was like, oh yeah, it would be very easy for us to just record with Jay since we're friends with him, and or I'm friends with him, so hopefully like we can afford it. And I don't know, like I'm not super precious about, there are not very many musicians I get like starstruck about. I think really the only person that would like, I don't know, blow up my brain is if I could make music with Bjork, but like there's really like nobody else. I don't know, I just don't really have like stars that I really want to, or like, you know, in our sure. DIY world of stars yeah. that are like I'm dying to do stuff with. Like I don't know, in weird ways, like I'm, because I guess I've been sort of alone in this DIY thing for so long. Like, I don't know. I've always like, maybe it's, I don't have the ego to think they'd want to work with me. I don't know. So yeah, working with Jay was just like comfortable because I trust him implicitly, and he's such a great ear. And as an engineer who actually pays attention to vocal takes, and he has opinions, and he'll be able to tell you what was a good take or a bad take. Like, he instantly knows, like, nope, do it again. And that's really helpful. Like, so many engineers I've worked with just don't give a shit. And they're, like, looking at their phones. They're barely, like, they're just, you know, capturing some recording, and then you tell them what to do.
Yeah.
So I love that working with Jay. Like, I feel like you're in a partnership with him, and a really exciting creative partnership. Like, he just continues to wow me every time. He is such a great listener and has such a great sense of right and wrong. Like, for so many different kinds of genres, he just can know when something can should be done again, or maybe like a different angle to approach it. He's really, really special in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never seen his name on anything as a musician or engineer or whatever that wasn't just, you know, a little bit mind blowing. So, you know, you mentioned that you were, that was a band that you and your husband started, and your newest band, Outer World, is also a band that you two started together. So obviously there was this history with Positive No. And so, you know, when that was time to move on from there, and then you two decided to start a new thing, like, it seems like it was the case of, like, you two wrote sort of an album, and now you have recruited people to go and play shows and go
exactly
on tour with y'all?
Yeah.
Okay.
So to backtrack a little bit, so again, because I haven't had a lot of people coming to me saying anything that I've done is great or worth being like attached to, Kenny was really the first person who, I mean, I guess that's not true. I've played music with other people I've dated, but like, Kenny has been the most supportive partner. Like, he really wants to listen to my ideas and trust me and thinks that I'm not insane the way I try to structure certain songs the way that I do. Like, his support of me learning and growing and keeping at it, like, I would have stopped playing music 20 years ago if it wasn't for Kenny, really, or 15 years ago. Like, he has been, like, my number one fan. And to have, you know, that person, like, literally in your corner because we live together, he makes me want to keep at it and learning and growing. Like, I don't know. It's been a hard path when you don't have a lot of other people pushing you to try to do it. Like, I'm not great at pushing myself. Mm-hmm. So to have somebody like, no, this is like a good start. Let's keep going and see what happens. Like, it's amazing what can happen when somebody believes in you.
Yeah.
It sounds like a simple thing, but honestly, like, it's really empowering. And it sucks that sometimes it takes another person to help, like, inspire you to keep at something. But for me, that was Kenny. And then we were sort of heading down, like, a more unusual. We were adding more, like, electronic elements and experimenting on Kyanite. And I don't think the rest of the band was quite as excited about that. And then we played like our last show with Jawbox, and then the pandemic happened, and then I got COVID and long COVID. And then I got super sick and didn't think I'd ever be able to sing again because I lost like my lung power, like the big Dahlia Seed voice. So again, Kenny was like, nope, we're going to find a way to keep making music together. I know you think you can't sing, but like, we're going to find a way to make music that you can sing. And so it was really bumpy. And like, you know, we had never really worked with certain kinds of computer softwares. Like, he basically had to learn an entire new language, and that's not something I have the patience to do, but he was like, no, I'll totally, like, download a bunch of different softwares and, like, I'm going to figure this out. And so these sort of, like, Stereolab broadcast kind of groups that we have always loved, it was not something I really understood how to make those kind of layered style songs. And COVID gave us that opportunity to just sort of learn that whole new language of layering and thinking about writing songs without just focusing on a guitar or a bass first. Like, really, that any kind of sound can be built into a song and become a song, and kind of redefining music in a way. So yeah. It, in some ways, it was really exciting because as a record collector and, like, I'm listening to music all the time, but also suddenly thinking about sounds and thinking, like, oh, that clunk or static sound, mm-hmm. or whatever, like, anything's possible to sample, manipulate, and potentially use for drums or texture. I don't know. It just really opened a whole bunch of new doors for us. And so, you know, the pandemic was really hard and scary for everybody. And I feel really grateful that I had this creative outlet to sort of lose myself in and kind of find myself again, yeah. I guess is the best way to explain that. It's a record that we certainly didn't expect to have happen. It was sort of like, I don't know, let's just keep writing songs. And some of the early songs weren't great. And everyone was like, yeah, this is, like, especially Positive No fans were like, this is interesting. Sounds like you guys are having fun. Like, I know what that's code for. Yeah. Right? We're still learning.
Yeah.
So the fact that we arrived in a place where, like, we actually had a record we would be super proud of, did not see that coming.
Yeah.
Such an awesome surprise, especially since I didn't think I'd be able to sing again, and getting my lungs back to not quite where it was, but definitely better.
Yeah. That's awesome. You said that this was you starting to learn about layered sounds and stuff, but actually, like, I think there's a bit of that in the Ring Finger album as well, because, like, when I heard the Ring Finger album, I was like, this is amazing. I'm going to write a record like this, and I'm going to release it under, like, one of my main bands, and people are going to be like, what the hell is this? This isn't what we're used to. And, like, I went away from that album, and I started writing a song, and, like, one of the main, like, hooks in it is, like, a bird. It's like a recording of a bird. And I was like, nah, this is cool. This is awesome. So, like,
right? It's like empowering when you, like, suddenly lose what you think are the rules of rock and roll and be like, oh shit, it can really be whatever I want it to be.
Next thing you know,
for me, Bjork was the one who opened those doors of electronic music for me.
Uh-huh.
I was not, like, an electronic music. I didn't know it. Like, it's not that I wasn't a fan. I just literally knew nothing about it. And Bjork transitioning from the Sugar Cubes to solo music that was super, like, dance music focused.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, working at Caroline, where, like, Astroworks was our core label, and that's, like, a really important electronic music dance label, and learning so much from that. And then, like, again, having my mind blown as to, like, how much electronic music can reshape a song in ways that you didn't think were possible.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out how to combine some of those things of that world into, you know, not totally losing the threads of what I grew up doing, which is always going to have some sort of melody.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the next thing you know, you're recording the way that your sink is dripping.
And maybe you're finding, like, our rhythm there that you're is, like, I'm not even kidding, there have been times where, like, I don't know, like a pattern of the windshield wiper where I'm like, oh, maybe that's, like, the tempo solution to how I break up my vocals for this verse.
Humming over it.
You're like, I mean, thank goodness our cell phones have ways to record notes, right? Like, I use that constantly.
Yeah, I'd be nowhere without the voice memo and without the notes app. Those are the lifesavers for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, the album is called Who Does the Music Love? And you're booking a pretty big tour, is that right?
Yeah, it's big for me. It's 2 weeks long, and it goes to the Midwest and back. I haven't played places like Detroit or Chicago since 96.
Oh, wow.
And honestly, because both myself and my husband also have like pretty intense day jobs, like touring is not something very easy to pull off. And the fact that like the band members that we've been doing live stuff with was all able to make it work as well. And our drummer was actually, he was in Doom Buggy and in Broken Mouth. And now he lives here and then was in Positive No and is now in Outer World. So we've been playing together basically since high school.
That's wild.
Yeah. So like, you know, we kind of fight. Like we're very brother and sister just because we like grew up together and know all the things about each other.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'm very lucky that I get to be in the band with my best friend and my husband. And then we just lucked out with two more members who are amazing, and Nate and Aaron. I don't think either one of them, Aaron has definitely never done a tour before, and Nate, I don't think has ever done one quite this big. So I'm excited. Like we're all going to be experiencing tour sort of like almost like the first time together. It'll be great.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited for you.
Thank you.
When is that all kicking off?
It starts on, I should probably know this by heart. Let me see if I can look at my phone with, of course, dates built in. So 4/24, which is a Wednesday.
Oh, yeah.
And we play with Collate, who are from Portland. They're an awesome, very angular post-punk group. And then Hard Copy, which is one of my favorite bands on Feel It, and definitely my favorite Richmond band. And then we head to Pittsburgh, and then we just keep on going from there. Cincinnati, Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, Boston. I don't know. There's a whole bunch more.
The whole route. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, by the time this airs, that'll just be a couple weeks away, really.
Yes. I don't want to say it's my last tour ever and that people will never be able to see me sing again, but like, I just can't imagine that I'm going to be able to keep doing this forever. Not just because I'm like a busy adult with a day job, but like touring is really hard on the body, and I'm already super nervous because my immune system is so jacked from COVID that like, I don't know. Can I sing every day for 2 weeks? I guess we're going to find out.
Yeah.
But like sleeping on floors, all of these things were like hard when you're 25, but like when you're doubling that, I might need some help getting up from floors now.
Yeah. Yeah. Need to pack an air mattress. I had to start doing that.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. Cause I was the drummer and the vocalist for a while in my band. And so I'm really, you know, cranking at it for 20 minutes, and I'm older, and in these hardwood cold floors, like I'm like, my family just has a history of back problems as well. So it was just like, no, but, yeah, I hope that you have a great time, and I hope that more often than not, somebody has a spare bed, you know, in a back room or somewhere for you.
I hope so. We've had some friends generously already offer some places to stay. So it looks like there are only maybe 5 cities that we don't really know what our sleeping situation is going to be. And we'll probably end up doing a hotel or something. So there'll be a couple cheater nights like here and there, but for the most part, I don't know. It's really expensive to tour because gas is so crazy expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Renting a van is crazy expensive. Like, I definitely am not expecting to make very much money from the shows we play. So, like, if we can break even, I'll be happy.
Yeah. I mean, eating food is expensive now.
Oh, my God, right? Yeah.
Like, everything.
Oh, that little thing.
Yeah, that thing. Okay, well, where should people, like, follow you all to keep abreast of all the news and everything, and like the show dates and everything like that. What's the best
place? Their Instagram account is okay. the best way to go.
Okay. And what's the handle there?
You should probably know that by heart, right? As a musician. God, I'm the worst. Who am I? Why am I here? Let me look at what the actual handle is.
Well, the Bandcamp.
Outer World Band. Okay. All in one.
Okay.
Thing.
And the Bandcamp, like, if to go listen to the album, the Bandcamp is outerworldsmusic.bandcamp.com. So, so yeah, Outer World Band and on Instagram, like, check out the tour dates, go see them when you can. It might be the last time, let's hope not, but you never know.
I do want to say one last thing. Sure. As a shout out. So Chris, the founding member of Dahlia Seed, is back in the hospital. He's been fighting brain cancer that's spread into his spine. And we got a text last night that he's back in the hospital and looks like he went into surgery today, I think. Not just because another mass has appeared, but I think there's some water on his brain.
Oh, no.
So I hope that, I don't know, sending out positive energy to Chris.
Yeah. 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 I
sorry. I know that's a heavy note to end on.
No, I also, you know, hope that that's all looking much better by the time, you know, people hear this.
Yeah, I know it was like a big dream of him to have Dahlia Seed rekindle in some way. We had talked about working on a record together, like just for ourselves, and not like we're not really reunion types, but I will say that the like silver lining of Chris getting sick is the whole band talks, and it's like on a text group almost every day. And like, I love that they're back in my life in that kind of like real way.
Yeah.
So it's been beautiful to see that sort of support again.
Yeah. Yeah. I almost was thinking, you know, that was something that was happening, you know, because, of the shirts and you know, like you said, Numero releasing, I mean, they're not the only ones that are, you know, doing that sort of like scooping up a legacy band or however you want to call it. And, you know, so I was almost kind of thinking that was possibly in the cards.
No, the shirts were to raise money for Chris and his family.
Awesome. And can people still get those?
Yeah, I actually do still have some shirts left. Okay. And I run like a small online record store called CourtesyDesk.shop.
Okay.
And there are some shirts there.
Okay. Awesome. Well,
and awesome DIY records from all around the world also for sale.
And that was my conversation with Tracy Wilson. Thank you so much, Tracy, for taking the time to chat with me. I feel like teenage me was just bursting out of my skin with joy. Thank you to all y'all wherever you're listening as well. Until next time, take care and do good things.